I'd like to convene the January 14th, 2016 meeting of the House Interim Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Good morning to you all. We have an ambitious agenda.
Afternoon, not morning.
Did I say morning? Good afternoon. Thank you. See?
First ever.
Thank. The first one ever. Thank you. We'll get that on the record.
Right, exactly.
Thank you, Vice Chair Krieger. Good afternoon, everyone. We have a fairly ambitious agenda this afternoon. We're going to be talking about a couple of wolf bills that have been introduced, and then we're going to hear from PENWR, the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, on invasive species and some potential money that may be available to the state to deal with that problem. And we, of course, held a hearing last session on that problem. And then we're going to have a work session that will introduce some of our legislative concepts. I want folks to know that approximately 2:30, or whenever I get the call from next door, I'm going to pass the gavel over to Vice Chair Krieger because I'm going to be testifying on another bill. So who's ever testifying at that time, it's not intended to be any kind of a dissing of you. It's because I've got to go testify on a bill. We're going to hear first the wolf bill, and I'm going to call up first, please, Representative Barreto and Senator Hansel. And it is my understanding that, please come up, gentlemen, and I understand that you have bills that are very similar, and Representative Barreto, one of yours may have a slight amendment that may be forthcoming. I don't know. You can tell us briefly about that, and I certainly don't expect either one of you to have to give any in-depth testimony. It's just an order opportunity here for you to introduce your concepts. So welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll go first, if that's okay. And for the good afternoon. For the record, Bill Hansel, State Senator for District 29. District 29 begins at the Hills Canyon on the Idaho border. It includes six full counties to the west, including Wallowa, Union, Umatilla, Morrill, Gillam, Sherman, and part of Wasco County. I mention this because this area is home to by far the largest population of gray wolves in Oregon. As many of you know, the legislature created the current wolf plan in 2013, establishing a comprehensive plan on how to conserve the species in the state in House Bill 3452. It passed out of the legislature 58-2 and the House 30-0. 58-2 in the House and in the Senate 30-0. The plan created a three-phase implementation program. It was bipartisan, bicameral, and Governor Kitzhaber signed it into law. Phase one established the criteria for breeding pairs for three consecutive years. 2013 was my first session, and I was a chief sponsor of House Bill 3452. This legislation was drafted for the sole purpose of helping to implement the Wolf Plan while also showing good faith efforts on behalf of the ranchers. Phase two called for 5-7 breeding pairs, as well as the delisting of the gray wolf during phase two. Currently, there are 81 known wolves, and in a presentation with ODF Wolf Program Coordinator Russ Morgan on October 27th, he believes there are probably 100 to 120 wolves in Oregon, and this does not include the pups from this past year. They'll come on the list, I believe, in April. When the Wolf Plan was created, there was an agreement between the ranchers, environmentalists, and ODF&W that when the wolves reached phase two, they would be delisted. The decision would be based on reviewing the science of whether the wolves should be delisted and a peer review of the conservation efforts ODF&W had made. According to the DOJ, ODF&W met all the requirements that were needed in order to move forward with the delisting. On November 9th, the commission voted 4-2 to delist the Canadian gray wolf in Oregon. This delisting will not bring about senseless violence against wolves. Wolves are still federally protected west of Highway 395. Also, with the Wolf Plan in effect, the Phase 3 and Phase 3 on the horizon, the wolves will still be protected. Even with delisting, it is still against the law to hunt and kill wolves in Oregon. It is time we honor the plan that was agreed to by everyone from the beginning. There are over 100 wolves in Oregon, according to Mr. Morgan, and the number is only going to increase. Phase 1 of the Wolf Plan has been a success, and ODFW has officially delisted the wolf. The LC, which is being introduced by the House Agricultural Committee, which Representative Barreto has been the chief author, ratifies the decision by ODFW. The department followed the law and every requirement put before them to move forward with the Phase 2 delisting. My bill in the Senate mirrors the same bill. We thought we would introduce them on both sides, but it is Representatives Barreto, and particularly if it comes out of the committee as a legislative bill, will be the primary vehicle to move this forward. Thank you for your time and the ability to speak during this hearing. I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Senator Hansel, thank you so much. You know, it's great to have you here before us. I think, committee members, if there's no objection, I'm going to hold off on any questions or comments until after Representative Barreto's had his opportunity to speak.
Well, thank you, Chairman Witt and committee. We did introduce bills, Senator Hansel from his chamber and me from the House, and we worked on them together, but they looked somewhat different. And one of the you asked me, Mr. Chair, as far as a change or an amendment that we were going to have in our LC draft, and that was in talking with those wolf advocates, they were concerned. We tried to run this bill last year, as you remember, and were not able to get it through. And one of the arguments on that bill was that it didn't have a caveat in there that if the numbers went down to Phase 1 levels that that they would be relisted again. And so in my draft, I did put that in there, but then decided to take it out because it's really not the legislature's objective to do that. But what we are doing is shoring up what the commission has already decided. They are the ones that make the decisions on this, and they do that based on the information that they receive from the biologist and from Fish and Wildlife. And so for me to put that in there would be, I think, overstepping our responsibility in the legislature and saying, no, this commission should be left to make those decisions, or the commission for Fish and Wildlife. So my bill will basically mirror Senator Hansel's bill, and what it does is just legislatively delist the gray wolf. Senator Hansel gave all of the information on the history on that. And so what we want to do is basically get the plan to where it continues to work like it was intended to work. It's been a 10 years since this plan has been in order. It has gone from Phase 1 into Phase 2. It has another year or two in Phase 2 before it goes to Phase 3, and the management process that Fish and Wildlife will then have the ability to manage the wolves rather than just let them go. And last year in this session or in this committee, the concern was that as soon as Fish and Wildlife delisted, that there would be a lawsuit against that decision. And just as predicted, there's a lawsuit. And so rather than hold up the plan with litigation, we would like to see this plan worked out as it was originally intended.
Thank you very, very much. I appreciate that. Committee members, are there any questions or comments for our colleagues? Yes, please, Representative Gorsuch.
Representative Barreto, so this legislation would supersede the lawsuit, is that correct?
As far as the law, to my understanding, there's been a lawsuit filed at the last,
right,
in December.
And would this legislation then quash that lawsuit?
No.
No.
I can answer that question.
Okay.
I think the certain groups went on record as intending to file. I don't think lawsuit has been dropped. information that I received, their intent. I think some of them are here. You can ask them. Okay. But I don't believe anything has been dropped. As Representative Barreto did, what we were trying to do is to shore up and to give the backing to ODFNW legislatively what it is. It would not supersede, nor would it prevent people from trying to sue.
Oh, okay.
I don't think you can do that legislatively, but it would be to back, and you'll see the wording once it gets out that it's, we've run it by the governor's office and other folks to get the right wording, and we think we've got it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much. Representative Frederick.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I said in the last hearing that I wanted to make sure that, people were being fair to one another, and that if we decided that we were going to have an agreement, that we were going to follow certain guidelines, scientific guidelines, that we follow them. We did, and I think that, and I applaud the scientists for doing that. I'm struggling a little bit on why we need additional legislation for this, and you've spoken about that. Perhaps you said it before I came in, because I apologize for being late. But why do we need additional legislation on this? If we're going to continue to follow, ODFNW is going to continue to follow the guidelines, why should we be dealing with something different? Are we trying to interrupt something? Are we anticipating that this will delay any other changes? Tell me a little bit about why we need this.
Yeah, my understanding. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Frederick. My understanding is that litigation can hold up the process for years, and this process has been going on for 10 years. It has been, I think, a difficult hardship on the ranchers in my district, and they have, I think, patiently and endured, you know, this hardship on their industry. And so if litigation would hold up the phase three process of management, then by my understanding is if we can pass legislation that shores up the delisting, then through the delisting process, then we can continue with the phase three wolf plan as it goes into the management stage.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Frederick, if I may add too, we as a legislature with tremendous bipartisan support created the wolf plan, and we ask a state agency to implement. They have done that. And they're getting sued. And what this, in my opinion, what this bill will do is to be on record to everybody that is there that we feel, as legislatures, that the state agency did, in fact, do what we asked them to do. So it may be taken for granted, it may not, but I think if they end up with a suit that comes down and people say, well, they didn't do what the legislature asked them to do, if we're on record as identifying that they did, then that might help shore up their position in a lawsuit.
Okay, I appreciate that. Follow up just a second.
Yes, Representative, please.
What I'm trying to get at is that the phase three, what I'm hearing you say is that the phase three process would not be able to be continued if there's a lawsuit. Is that what you believe is taking place?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it wouldn't be continued, but it would be held up.
It would be held up.
Yeah. So, you know, litigation can last for years and years.
Sure.
And if that prevents going into the management stage, then by all means, it would be held up forever. No, there would be a time, but that means that the management of the wolves would be held off, possibly for years.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative McKeown.
Chair Witt, thank you. Gentlemen, I appreciate your work on this bill. I had the privilege of traveling over to the northeastern section of the state and being in those conversations with the folks up in Wallowa County. And it's a whole different ballgame when you actually get on the ground out there and see the impact that this is having. And I think the work that we have done to this point has been good. But there were two other issues that were raised when we were over there visiting with your constituents. And one of them had to do with the amount of money that is in the Wolf Depredation Compensation Fund. And the other one had to do with the ranchers who have a wolf kill that is analyzed by ODF&W staff. And there's a discrepancy as to whether it's a wolf kill or not in the appeal process for that. And there was some question as to the validity of the appeal going through the same agency for which the question has arisen. And I just wondered if you wanted to comment on that, and are there any opportunities in the future to address those issues?
Thank you, Representative McEwen, or Chair Witt, and Representative McEwen. And again, we want to thank you for coming. For the first issue is on the compensation. I've taken the lead, and there is a letter that is being submitted today in the reconciliation bill in the short session that we might get more compensation there. The fact that each of us only had two bills, we didn't have enough bills to make it into a bill and drop it as such, but we were advised, and thank you for your signature on it, to go that route. So the compensation, there's a request in for $400,000, justified, we feel, with a number of good bipartisan signatures on it. So that'll be coming up in the short session. The second area of, Representative Barreto can, our second question he can explain too. We didn't want to confuse and get too much in this bill. We wanted to focus on the delisting.
Okay.
And so there were a number of issues that at some point we probably want to, health and human safety, the way things are analyzed. But the more we put into this, the delisting and backing the department that is trying to follow our legislative direction, that is what we wanted to concentrate on. That's what we've tried to do.
Follow. And I appreciate the explaining that. Those are issues that appear to be conversations that maybe we want to continue at some point in time, and I perfectly understand keeping in the short session things clear and concise and simple, but I just don't want to lose those topics as we move forward, and I'll look forward to having those conversations in the 17 session. Yeah. Thank you so much for your work.
I would like to comment on that, Chair Witt, Representative McEwen. As far as the depredation and the analysis of that must be done by Fish and Wildlife. I think it used to be Fish and Wildlife, and Ash will have testimony on this later, but there is an issue with Fish and Wildlife then determining whether it is indeed a confirmed kill or not by wolves, to where they would not just get compensation, but also that it would in effect be a mark against that pack, because in the bill, if a pack, you know, has depredation, I think three times within 6 months, then there can be room for lethal take. And so if the rancher feels like he's being basically discriminated against, and they don't want to go to the point of lethal take, because that stirs up a lot of emotion. Then they have no source to really appeal those confirmed kills. I mean, or you know, they you appeal it to the same party that made the decision to begin with, you know, and so it's not like you're going to a third party administrator to say, well, what really happened here, or auditor, or whatever, you know. So that's the issue with that, and that can be, like Bill said, or Senator Hansel said, that can be worked out later, I think, but right now the issue is following through with the plan and the delisting that the commission has already decided.
Representative Witt, if I may add,
yes.
Mr. Chair, one other thing, too, is that as we have worked on this, and we've been doing it for several months, we've kept our constituents, the producers, the others, actively involved almost word for word. So it's we haven't done this in a vacuum. And I would anticipate the hearing that you have from some of the folks that have traveled some distance to be here today, that they would be in agreement with the direction that we're and what we're trying to do.
Thank you very, very much. Anything further for our colleagues? Seeing nothing. Gentlemen, thank you truly for coming in and presenting your bill concepts to us. Thank you so much.
And like you, Representative, Mr. Chair, I've got other meetings
and
testimony and stuff, so I'll probably leave at some point.
Thank you very much. I want to call committee members here before we take a brief recess. I want to call to your attention two items in your information packet that were handed out. One prepared by Mr. Crawford, who probably is not going to be our committee administrator, at least for this upcoming session, because he has conflicting committee assignments. And as many of you know, Mr. Roper was also his assistant assisted this committee in several meetings and so is not new to this committee and does tremendous research. First, Mr. Crawford prepared a wolf management brief. So this kind of gives you a history of the wolf issue. I would encourage you to take a look at that. And then overnight, folks, this is overnight. This is the kind of research that Mr. Roper is capable of. Overnight, researched the record from April's hearing, April of 15, the 6 hours of testimony that we had day and night, and drafted the issues and then kind of the points that various folks who came and testified made in behalf or in opposition to the various issues here. And I would like for us to keep this in mind so that we probably don't have to have six more hours. Maybe we could reduce six to an hour would be great. So
thank you.
So wonderful job. Thank you so much. With that, I'm going to go off record, and I'm going to ask that the vice chairs please meet with your caucuses, respectively. Thank you. And with that, I'm going to call up our first panel of this afternoon from ODF&W, please, Ron Anglin and Kevin Blakely.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Good afternoon.
And members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ron Anglin, the Wildlife Division Administrator. With me today is Kevin Blakely, the new Deputy or Assistant Administrator for the Wildlife Division, who was the Watershed Manager over in Pendleton. And he has some firsthand background and knowledge with wolves. Our intent today, with the time that you've allotted us, is to give you just a very brief history and overview of wolves in Oregon, some of the stuff that went into the development of the Wolf Conservation Plan. You've heard a bunch of it already, but just give you some real high-level things, some of the things that are going on from a population standpoint, and what ultimately led to our proposal to the Commission on a delisting, and then also finish up with the Wolf Plan review process that we're looking to engage in. You know, wolves were native to Oregon. They were extirpated in the state by the late 30s, 1930s, and, you know, were gone. And it wasn't until the reintroductions in the Rocky Mountain states by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as part of the Yellowstone releases in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, and the population expanding from there that we started seeing wolves coming back into Oregon. And the first documented wolf in Oregon was in 1999, a female that had been collared in Idaho. We actually worked with the Fish and Wildlife Service to capture that wolf, and it was returned to Idaho. The service informed us in the future, they would not allow us to do that. They're fully protected under the federal ESA here in Oregon, and that if wolves showed up, we were going to have to deal with them as an ESA species. Based on that and some additional wolves starting to show up in the state, in about 2003, the department decided that we wanted to undergo a review of wolves, the potential for wolves showing up in the state, and whether we needed to take any action as a state agency, a Fish and Wildlife Agency, for management. And as a result of that, our commission asked us to put on a series of workshops. We had four different workshops in front of the commission. We brought in 29 guest speakers from around the U.S. and Canada to talk to our commission and inform them on wolf management. We held 16 public informational hearings around the state with over 2,000 people in attendance and received a lot of comments. After the end of that, our commission directed us to go ahead and develop a wolf management plan. And we appointed, our commission appointed a small work group representing the landowner community, the hunting community, public educators, the wolf conservation community, and public at large. And those folks spent 18 months developing that original wolf plan that was adopted by our commission in 2005. And as you've heard from several different people, within that wolf plan, there's a bunch of different management approaches. And the wolf plan is a three-phased approach. Phase one is a conservation phase. It establishes a minimum breeding population and a goal of reaching that, and that you've got a lot of restrictions in place to conserve wolves as a result of that. During this process, keep in mind that wolves in Oregon, when they did show up, were federally listed, as well as they were grandfathered onto the state ESA when the legislature adopted that back in the 1980s. So with the development of the wolf plan and the three phases, we had the conservation phase, which is phase one. Phase two is kind of that transition phase, we call it, where you're in between conservation and potential management. And then phase three is the management phase. It was contemplated in phase one that there would be a lot of protection for wolves, and that as you transitioned into phase two, when you had more wolves on the landscape, that there'd be a little more flexibility in dealing with damage problems and addressing some of the additional concerns that came out of the landowner community. It also was contemplated that once you entered into phase two, the commission could, as you heard, consider a delisting of wolves from the state list. Didn't say that they had to delist, but it said to consider. We still had to meet the conservation mandate of the state ESA and meet the requirements of the state ESA, and that was what needed to go in front of the commission for them to make the ultimate decision. And then as we moved into more documented breeding pairs, phase three, again, it opens up management options if the commission chooses to do so, allows the ability to address concerns related to conflict with damage areas, high-intensity damage areas, allows the commission to contemplate if there's documented wolf impacts on ungulate populations that we could take some action to relieve that pressure on the ungulates. The state was divided into two wolf management zones. The stuff in blue is the west zone, or the stuff in light blue is the west zone, and the dark blue and green is the eastern zone. And the delisting criteria really in phase one were really aimed at where we expected wolves to show up first, which was the eastern zone, and that once we reach that phase one for breeding pairs for three consecutive years in the eastern zone, if the commission chose to delist, we still would retain ESA-like restrictions. Even though they were statewide delisted, we would still retain ESA-like restrictions in the western zone until that four breeding pairs for three consecutive years conservation goal had been met in the western zone. This map also demonstrates that originally all of Oregon was federally listed. A couple years ago, the Congress actually delisted wolves in the Rocky Mountain distinct population segment, and as part of that, they delisted a portion of eastern Oregon, and that is the green hatched version that you see on the map. So a portion of our eastern zone is still federally listed. All of western Oregon is still federally listed, and the green area is federally delisted. And Oregon has full authority and control of wolf management in that green zone as a result of that federal action taken by Congress. What has the wolf population done through time? It has grown. You know, from the first documented wolf pack in 2008 up until 2015, we now have 16 documented wolf packs, actually 17 documented wolf packs, because we had another one just recently confirmed this week that we posted on our website. And what you see here in population numbers, these are actual known wolves at the end of the calendar year, with the exception of 2015 that we did as part of our delisting consideration for the commission. So it's known wolves that we've counted at the end of the year. Does not, if you can't count pups in the middle of the summer because you don't know how many of those are going to survive. So even though we have adults that we knew had pups in July, we didn't count those in any kind of assessment we put in front of the commission because we didn't know how many of those would survive, and the standard we use is the end of the year survival standard. So, you know, as of July, we had the 81 known wolves in Oregon. We know that of the 16 packs at the time, we knew there virtually all of them had reproduction and had pups. We're out right now actually doing our counts and confirming how many of those qualify as breeding pairs and the survival of those pups. When you look at wolves across the state, we designate where we have a pack and they've settled in as an area of known wolf activity, or an AQUA, and you can see that most of those are clustered in northeast Oregon. Where you see things with just a circle, that's indicative of a pack that we're aware of, but we don't have a GPS collar on. So we just have a standard circle that we put around that for a territory. The ones with the irregular shapes, we have GPS collars on, and we've been able to define what that pack's territory is, actually. And I've got a slide a little bit later that we'll show you that really shows how northeastern Oregon is connected with the Cascades. So the delisting that was put in front of the commission really was as a result of the direction that was provided within the wolf management plan that was adopted back in 2005. That once we met the phase one criteria of four or more breeding pairs for three consecutive years in a row, the commission could consider delisting. At the end of 2014, wolves had met that criteria. So we'd had three consecutive years of four or more breeding pairs, and that then triggered for us to put the question in front of the commission. And what we did in April of 2015 was a fairly comprehensive biological status review of wolves in Oregon, and put that out in front of the commission and said, it appears to us that wolves likely meet, within the plan, they meet the criteria to consider delisting. Biologically, it appears that they do. Would you like for us to move forward with any kind of a proposal or not? And they said, yes, we do want you to bring that to us with some options, and that's what we undertook from that point in time. It's important to note that the state ESA requires five delisting criteria be met. And I've paraphrased these here on the screen. You have the full text in the packet of materials that were provided to you. But these five things, you know, we have to be able to meet in order for the commission to make a determination that it's okay to delist. You know, are they in danger of extinction across any significant portion of the range in Oregon? Is there any kind of potential for a natural reproduction failure of the population? is there active deterioration of their range or habitat going on that would jeopardize their survival, long-term survival? Is there overutilization of wolves in the state? And finally, is there regulatory certainty or rules or laws in place that would provide the necessary protection for wolves to ensure that they would not backslide and require a relisting? As stated earlier, we've got a lot of information that really played into the evaluation that we made. And the last three criteria on the previous slide, you know, the regulatory certainty, the range, the reproduction failures or potential for failure, really those were all things that were fairly easy to address by the commission and by staff. And when we got into the significant portion of the range piece, this is a map that we put up that we called the ball of yarn map. And you think back to the original map I showed you earlier of all those areas of known wolf activity and where those packs were located. Well, here is a map showing wolves that have dispersed from those packs that had GPS collars on them. These are only the ones with GPS collars on them. There are other wolves with no collars that appeared to have followed similar path. And it shows the connectivity from northeast Oregon into the Cascades, but it also shows the interchange going on with the state of Washington and the interchange going on with the state of Idaho and the interchange going on with Montana. So we have had wolves disperse out of Oregon and also into California. So we've had wolves disperse out of Oregon into four different states. And we know based on past information that wolves are dispersing out of Idaho and likely Montana into Oregon. So there is interchange going on by wolves across the landscape out here. So looking at all of that, we updated our biological status review and presented that evaluation of those five delisting criteria to our commission in October of 2015. The commission took a lot of public comment at that meeting, and ultimately the commission asked us to bring back to them so they could evaluate three options for delisting: delist the whole state, a partial state delisting, and a no action or a no delist decision. In November of 2015, we brought that information back to the commission. They evaluated that biological status review that we'd pulled together, which included what was the risk of wolves going extinct based on the numbers that we had today if they were delisted. The commission listened to public input, and they determined that the delisting criteria had been met. I will tell you, though, that the commission really debated a lot on whether to delist the whole state or to do a partial state delisting. Mm-hmm. And I think that if they would have had the option for a partial state delisting, they might have gone there. However, the way the state ESA is currently written, it's an all-or-nothing thing. And I think they were very disappointed that they didn't feel that they had a comfortable way to move forward with a partial state delisting based on the information that was presented to them. But the state ESA just didn't allow that. And ultimately,
Representative Frederick?
Going back a couple of slides then, basically they didn't have three options.
Ultimately, no, they ended up not having three. They had two options: to delist the whole state or to not delist.
Thank you.
Ultimately, the commission, after a lot of discussion and debate and a couple of different executive sessions during the course of the day, made the decision to delist wolves statewide. And that's where we're at today. And then we'll wrap up real quick. Kevin, kind of talk about real fast our plan evaluation process that we're entering.
Thanks, Ron. Mr. Chairman, again, for the record, Kevin Blakely, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Deputy Administrator for the Wildlife Division. Ron outlined very briefly kind of a 16-year history of the activity and conversation that has evolved with wolf management, from trapping a wolf that had a collar that wandered into Oregon that went back to Idaho, to now the meeting conversation or the conservation objectives and delisting wolves in Oregon. The next step in the process that Wildlife Division is undertaking is to move forward on a path for the wolf plan evaluation. We'll be briefing commission on our proposed review process and timeline. Some components of that process of review will be some very important stakeholder input. As we begin that, we'll be updating biological information, including some new science. There's been two other significant wolf management plans that were adopted by Washington and California that have some key components and new information in that. And then also to be able to evaluate the effectiveness of what was outlined in a current plan and move forward on some strategies for the future. We plan to present to the commission in the fall of this year with what that review would look like, and as part of that process, as well as it would be a significant amount of public opportunity for comment. And with that, Ron?
So, Chair Witt, that's all we had for you today.
Gentlemen, thank you very, very much for that that background. And those maps, at least for myself, were exceedingly helpful. So thank you. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ron, could you go back to the squiggly thing, what you called the ball of yarn? Isn't the green down into California just OR7?
Yes, that's OR7.
I mean, that guy was running around everywhere. I'm Full surprised he didn't go to Vegas.
Reno.
Are you sure he didn't?
Hey, I'm not sure he didn't.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On a little more serious note, Ron, you were talking about 17 packs now that they just discovered another pack. Would you define the difference between a pack and a breeding pair?
So a pack is two or more wolves that are running together and are staying in an area for a period of time. Actually, I called it pack, but it's also an area of known wolf activity. So like OR7, when he went to California and then came back into Oregon, even though he was by himself when he was in Oregon, once he settled into an area, we designated that as an area of known wolf activity. So that kind of triggers for us interaction with landowners. Hey, we've got a wolf in the area. You know, you need to be thinking about stuff and what's going on, what you're doing. Here's what the wolf plan calls for. You know, in the case of the Cascades, it's federally listed, things like that. A breeding pair is two adults with at least two pups at heel at the end of the year. So an area of known wolf activity can be a pack, or it can just be an individual wolf. A pack is multiple wolves that are running together. So there's kind of three different terms in there.
So do packs typically turn into breeding pair?
They certainly can. And once you have a pack where you've got a male and a female that end up exhibiting the traits that allow them to become the alphas, then they will breed, and you'll end up with the potential, if they're able to successfully raise their pups, the potential for them to become a breeding pair. We had one female that, quite frankly, had pups every year, but she was not good at raising pups, and her pups never did well. She'd go to a certain point in time, and then she'd just walk away from them.
Representative Whitsitt, followed by Representative Esquivel.
Thank you. We have one that's not on there, right? A female that showed
correct.
Up in Lake County this last week, right?
That's correct. And I did state that when I showed the map of all the areas of known wolf activity, there was one additional one that had just shown up that it is in Lake County. I didn't show them on the map where it was, but it is in your area. And it does appear that there may be two wolves there.
That follow up. That was my question. What is like the known occurrence of single female wolves showing up into an area and staying there alone, that in your knowledge, that they've never been in before?
Well, certainly, Chair Witt and Representative Whitsitt, females disperse equally with the males, and they will disperse as individual animals. And like the males, when they do disperse, they're looking for a mate, most likely, or looking for a place that they can settle in with other wolves. They may become part of a pack, but not a breeding part of the pack, until they get to a certain point and then split off again. And so we have no clue if there was a male there already and the female found the male, or the female showed up and the male was tagging along. And we just don't know how that happened.
Oh, one last
please.
Thing. Do you collar all the wolves in the state? So will you know if there is a male with her unless she has pups, shows up with pups next spring?
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, no, we do not collar every wolf. We do try, and according to our wolf plan, does direct us to try and hang at least one collar on a wolf in every pack. You may not end up collaring alphas. You may end up collaring younger wolves that disperse, which is why you go back in and recollar in a pack sometimes. And so what we do, once we do have wolves show up in an area like this, we'll put out trail cameras, and it's amazing what you can find out from trail cameras. You know, that's how we actually found the wolves out in the Pakegama area in Johnson Prairie, was with trail camera sets. And you're able to tell males and females while they're doing their business on camera. They don't seem to be shy about that. And so we're able to document it and things like that, and we can also document it if we can collect scat and do the DNA analysis.
Just one last thing. How many wolves would you estimate that you don't know are out there based on... You talk about the trail cams picking up things you totally had no idea. So would it be logical to assume that there are additional numbers that we don't know based on that occurrence and, you know, the one in Lake County?
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, we obviously know there's more wolves out there than what we know about. How many there are, we don't know. And as an example, one of the wolves that was reported to us this winter in the Cascades, or last summer in the Cascades, was a collared male with a VHF collar, so it wasn't a GPS collar, that we had lost track of 3 years ago. The collar went dead. And we assumed that wolf was dead. But all of a sudden, a hunter came to us and said, "Guess what? I think I found a wolf, and I think it's got a collar on it, and the only wolf with that kind of collar out there is the one that was missing." So, you know, it had been out there for 3 years. Nobody had documented it. We had no clue where it was, and things like that happen all the time. The three wolves out on Johnson Prairie, we'd had reports. We went out, set cameras, and we found tracks on some of the logging roads. We set cameras, and we documented three wolves, and none of them had collars on them. So, you know, we've tried to go back and capture those wolves and hang collars on them, just not been successful.
Thank you.
Wait till the TSA finds out about trail cameras. Mm-hmm. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see that we had two packs in Southern Oregon. Looks like we're getting a third. Is that what it is, or a breeding pair? Because I noticed you had a circle down there, and then you had two packs. You had one on one side of Klamath, the other between Medford and Klamath, up north of us, and then you had one, looked like in the flats area down by the California border.
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, we actually now have four areas of known wolf activity down in the Southern Cascades, and then just to the east of there, north and east of Klamath Falls. So there's two in the Southern Cascades that we're aware of. There is one that is just north of Klamath Falls in the forested area, and then one just to the east in Lake County in the forested area. That the one in Lake County was not on the map. We just announced that actually earlier this week and have not had a chance to update the maps yet.
Thank you.
So, Ron, can you tell us, is I-5, does that present some kind of barrier that wolves haven't ventured into extreme western Oregon? Or
Chair Witt, you know, we wonder about I-5 and Interstate 84, and we certainly, you know, from this map, it's obvious that wolves are crossing Interstate 84.
Yeah.
And you also look at OR-7, the green line that comes down into the Southern Cascades and into California, and the stuff on the far left of the map actually shows that OR-7 went west of I-5. So he was able to find a way to get across I-5, and it was up on the crest of the Siskiyous. And if you're familiar with that, there's several places where there's some major canyons or draws with bridges over that likely served as corridors for them to cross. Now, what will happen up north as you get into areas where you don't have those kind of features, and it's more of just straight freeway and flat land back and forth across, we don't know. We certainly have seen wolves, and OR-7 was one of them. When he came across Central Oregon here and got over into this area and saw a bend, he put the brakes on pretty quick. And likewise, when he came down, this map doesn't show it real well. I just lost my mouse. Doesn't show it real well, but just south of the 97 sign on there, he actually paralleled Highway 97 for a little ways and seemed reluctant to cross it, but then decided time was right and he was going across, and he did, just like that. We've had others that came up to 97 and they never even slowed down. They just went. So the thing that everybody has to remember is up until the mid-90s here in the West, none of us had ever dealt with wolves in modern times. You know, it had been since the 30s since wolves have been present. So we're learning a lot about wolves. Wolves are going to tell us where they're going to go, and because we may think we know where they're going to go, but we don't know for sure until they tell us.
All right. Anything further, committee members? Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Excellent presentation.
Thank you.
Committee members, before we entertain our next panel, we're a half hour behind, and I've got to find some place to make up some time. Do any of the members have bills that you intend to introduce? Not committee bill, but your own personal bills today?
No.
Does anybody have any? All right, that's where we're going to gain some time. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. So our next panel, I'm going to call up, please, Jim Ankinson, Tyler Alexander, Todd Nash, and Rocky Dollum. And if we need another chair here, it looks like. Okay. Thank you. Please determine among yourselves the order of your testimonies. Welcome to our committee. Welcome, gentlemen.
Chairman Witt and members of the committee, my name is Tyler Alexander. I'm the new Governmental Affairs Associate for the Oregon Farm Bureau. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today on a legislative concept that is very important to our 7,000-member family, farmers, and ranchers. The Oregon Farm Bureau is a strong advocate for delisting the gray wolf at the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission, and this legislation is critical to fully implementing that decision. As you're aware, Oregon Wolf Conservation Management Plan called for initiating a process to delist wolves from the OESA when Oregon ranches reaches the conservation objective of 4 breeding pairs for 3 consecutive years. That objective was met in 2014. ODFW's biological status review found that factors related to wolf health, habitat dispersal, habitat connectivity, and wolf survival all indicate a healthy and growing population that is unlikely to decline in the near term. Based on the findings in the biological status review and available data, the decision to delist the wolves was scientifically sound. There is simply no need to continue to extend OESA protection to the wolf as this population continues to increase. The groups that oppose wolf delisting would like to see protections in place for wolves beyond the wolf management plan, and are using a legal challenge to the delisting decision as that vehicle to achieve that goal. Their methods are misplaced. The state will evaluate wolf management in Oregon in its upcoming wolf management plan review, and the opposition groups will be part of that effort. They will have the opportunity through that process to advocate for changes in management they feel are needed, and will be able to raise any concerns with current management through that process. From a policy perspective, it is important that the state legislature ratify the decision of the Fish and Wildlife Commission. In delisting, the commission chose to honor its commitments it made to Oregon producers in the Wolf Plan and forced all parties who had agreed to the current Wolf Management Plan to honor their commitments as well. The promise that commitments would be honored was a significant factor in producers' willingness to honor the Wolf Plan, despite the significant cost of wolf depredation to their operations. Delisting is a critical part of Phase 2 of the Wolf Plan, which also provides producers with the ability to manage their livestock operations to help protect against wolf depredation as wolf populations continue to grow. Oregon producers have honored the agreement with the state to follow the Wolf Plan. Delisting of the wolves fully implements Phase 2 of the Wolf Plan, respects the commitments made to all of the stakeholders who participated in the Wolf Plan, and ultimately provides greater flexibility to the state in making long-term management decisions regarding wolves. Oregon Farm Bureau urges the legislature to support this legislation and ratify the commission's decision to honor its commitments and delist wolves once agreed to population objectives were met. Thank you, and I'm happy to take any questions you may have at the conclusion.
We'll have him testify first. Go ahead and give your testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Vice Chair Krieger, rest of the representatives. My name's Jim Akinson. I'm the Conservation Director for the Oregon Hunters Association. We are a group, we are the largest sportsman's group in the state of Oregon. We have about 10,000 members. There's about 300,000 hunters in the state of Oregon. And I'm going to talk a little bit about moving forward from this time of delisting decision, but I'm going to go out to 10,000 feet. We've been talking 1,000 feet. That's the state of Oregon. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about the metapopulation. That's a common phrase in carnivore biology, metapopulation. This is the Northern Rockies population of wolves. There's about 290 packs there, estimated number 1,645. This is from a couple years ago. And this is the nucleus from a dispersal standpoint that we in Oregon receive our wolves from. And you can see the Highway 97 line there, 395, in Oregon going up into Washington that Ron Anglin was referring to. So this is that Northern Rocky Mountain population. This is a focus on Idaho, which is the primary source for dispersal for the state of Oregon. And this is GPS locations over just a couple year period in that state. And you can see that's an incredibly high density of wolf locations. And you undoubtedly gathered from Ron's display, kind of the yarn ball phenomena, that wolves move a lot. And that's something to really keep in mind in this situation. And I guess I don't need to put an exclamation mark on this, because obviously OR7 has moved a lot more than 350 miles. But they are incredible travelers, something to always keep in mind. My background, I've spent the majority of my professional career in the living and working in the Central Idaho Wilderness, where wolves were first established. I spent 10 years doing research with wolves while I was a scientist with the University of Idaho. And also, I was with Oregon's wolf biologist, Russ Morgan, when he did his first wolf capture, which is this wolf. So looking at the criteria that ODFW has laid out, for assessing the successfulness of wolves. I think it's incredibly robust from a scientist's standpoint. If you look at conservation failure, getting down to less than 4 breeding pairs, that is an extremely unlikely phenomena at this point from a statistical perspective. That's 0.01 probability of that ever happening. And also something that, to add to the conservativity, if there is such a word, of the projection that OFDW has made in their model, it really isn't fully taking into consideration dispersal from the metapopulation. And that's what I want to make a punctuation mark on. Our position as an organization, we're a conservation organization. We believe in science being applied to wildlife management. I am a scientist by training. I am the organization's first conservation director. So as we move into the future, we want to apply science. And basically, we feel it's time to delist wolves in Oregon. They have met and exceeded the scientific criteria identified in the Oregon Wolf Plan. Oregon sportsmen, as voiced by OHA, want to see the plan followed, and we want to participate in the next round of planning. Both the current plan and the next wolf plan have and will outline scientific and cautious conservation measures for this species in Oregon, and will carry on the three-phased approach to management with strict population criteria as we progress from one phase to the next. And I just want to talk about one person's input as we went through the delisting process, and that's a scientist named David Meech. He lives in Minnesota. He's done about 52 years of research with wolves, and he was in strong agreeance that it was time in Oregon to delist, and he based that assessment and that input on dispersal characteristics. And I hope that you will strongly look at what's going on outside of Oregon and not just within the state. I think there's ample justification for the reproductive capacity and dispersal that we've seen in Oregon. But when you put that in context with the metapopulation, I believe it's overwhelming. So that's all I have.
Thank you very much. I am assuming in my absence you both presented. Committee members, questions? Representative Barreto, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In Idaho, Jim, how long have the wolves, according to this map and the spread of the wolves, how long have they been in Idaho to get to these?
There's two releases of wolves, gray wolves, in Idaho. The first one was in 95 and the second one was in 96. There was a total of 35 individuals brought into the state. By the year 2000, there was a very similar number as what we're looking at now, just over 100 individuals. In the decade from 2000 to 2010, they increased to near or above 1,000. And actually, there's been management, i.e. harvest, trapping by Wildlife Services trappers, and hunting by sportsmen for the last 6 years. And currently the population in Idaho is estimated at right around 800. So even with that harvest and removal, they've continued to be quite robust. And one other thing I'd like to touch on, Ron Anglin was asked the question, how many unknown wolves are there in these situations where you have active radio collaring programs, and I was involved in a fairly intensive capture activity in the Central Idaho Wilderness along with the Nez Perce tribe, who at the time I was involved in research had jurisdiction over the wolves. And we always figured that there was at least 40% that we were missing. And that's with some pretty active effort.
Thank you. I have Vice Chair Krieger with Representative Esquivel on deck, and Representative Whitsitt in the hole.
Jim, you spent how many years in Idaho doing this?
11 years doing research.
Can you just briefly tell us
from the time there was introduction of the 35 until Idaho, I think they had an open season on wolves, what was the kind of general impact on a big game, elk and deer, antelope?
Well, I'll give you a very specific example from the game management unit I lived in and worked in, and that's Unit 26, the Big Creek Drainage in the River of No Return Wilderness. And our population counts, game counts on elk, were reaching a peak in the late 90s, around 1,600 elk. And by the time I moved out from the wilderness and left that position in 2010, we were under 300 elk. So we went from 1,600 elk to 300. There were four big game outfitters that operated in the area where we lived and did research. And by the time we left, that was down to two. They just couldn't continue to do their business without any harvestable resource available.
Just a little follow-up.
Please.
I kind of understood about where those numbers were, so I've talked to some of those people. But there's been a huge financial impact in the rural communities that are dependent upon fish and wildlife from predation.
Yeah.
And I think people need to understand that there's got to be a balance in there somewhere. How many is enough, and how many do you need before you start really having a negative impact on animals that are important to people?
Yeah. And yeah, well, to comment on that, this is fascinating to me, this whole phenomena. It's like time traveling, and I feel like I'm going back in time 15 years, having come from the Idaho situation to here. Things haven't played out exactly the way I would have predicted here in Oregon, and a lot of that's driven by landscape features of this state. But I think it's pretty erroneous to think that Oregon isn't going to fill up with wolves. I think that that's a grave error, because Oregon has a lot of not only ideal habitat, but it has a huge and abundant prey resource.
Jim, you mentioned the decline in ungulates, and I read it's been a couple of years now. I can't remember whether it was Field and Stream or Outdoor Life. I believe it was one of those two magazines, and it pretty much told a similar story. But we have to be guided by science here. Mm-hmm. And has there been a direct cause and effect relationship established between the wolves and the decline in those ungulates, or do we just see that the ungulates decline and we don't necessarily, no one has established that scientific cause and effect?
I think it has been established. Uh-huh. Not only the research that we did, but other researchers, including the Yellowstone phenomenon. I think if you look at the elk population in Yellowstone now compared to what it was prior to the release, it's radically different. And it's interesting also to currently look at what's going on in Idaho with an active harvest program. A lot of those elk populations are responding positively. So,
Ron, would you have anything to add to this at this point, scientifically? No. Okay. Mr. Roper, would you make it a point to follow up on this point and see if there is a scientific report out there? Because I've heard from a lot of different sources reports that there is a very steep decline in ungulate populations in wolf areas. I would like to see if there's actual science behind that. Ron Anglin?
I changed my mind.
All right. Thank you.
I would let you know that we are undertaking research in the Mount Emily unit, looking at wolf, cougar, deer and elk interaction. We just completed a study looking at cougar and elk and deer interaction, and now wolves have moved into that unit, so it gives us the opportunity to look at that here. Oregon has a lot more deer than some of these other states. We don't know how that will play out with wolves on the landscape. And I would say that in both Montana and Idaho, they demonstrated that you have to be careful in assuming that wolves are the cause, because they assumed that on a couple of the herds they were studying, and when they were all said and done, they found out it actually was cougars that was suppressing the population and not wolves like they had assumed it was.
Okay.
And so it's you got to make sure you understand what's going on.
Precisely. And thank you for that, because before we make the mental leap that we have an apex predator and therefore that's the cause, I want that scientific connection. And so if anyone has that, if it exists, I'd like you to please contact Mr. Roper so he can document that. With that, folks, committee members, help me. Representative Esquivel, did you ask your question?
No, I
haven't. Okay, please.
In Idaho, I was in McCall, Idaho, several years ago, and it was National Sportsman's Caucus. We had a national convention there. And the fellow from the Department of Natural Resources, or whatever you call it in Idaho, was talking about a scenario of what you were saying, that they had X amount of elk in an area. The wolf population grew. The elk population fell off the table. And they went in and harvested, I can't remember, but it was like 15 or 20 wolves. And then that population started coming back up with the elk. So there's a tipping point. Now, how many tags did they give out in Idaho a year? Do you have any feel for that?
It's about 220.
Okay, that's
and
about right.
Here recently, the harvest on wolves has been about 180 on an annual basis, roughly in that neighborhood.
And okay, were you at McCall when we were up there?
Or
were
I was east of McCall.
Pardon?
I was east of McCall.
Okay.
You know where Yellow Pine is?
No.
You know how Montana has a nose on the map when you look at a weather map? I was one nose length off the nose.
One nose off the nose.
But one thing, please, Chair Witt, follow up on what Ron said. He brought up a very good point. It does vary. There's a lot of different factors that determine predation effect. Where I was living and where that example is given of going from 1,600 to basically, I think it was 265 elk, is a hole. It's one drainage. All the animals migrate down into it. And we had basically five packs that lived in a 50-mile stream drainage. And they were new on the scene. And that's another factor, is this newness as they disperse. They're like kids in a candy store. And they really capitalize on the resource at hand. Things balance out over time. I think that another thing that Ron didn't mention that I would like to mention is time is a critical component with this, to allow enough time for things to shake out. But when wolves are new and they're concentrated on one of our game populations, they can have an incredible effect.
I have Representative Whitsitt followed by Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Akinson. I just want to mention, I grew up, my family still has ranches in southwest Montana in Beaverhead County, and last week, for the first time in recorded history, the elk herd went down to the Beaverhead River just north of Park Canyon Dam. And there are wolves. They're coming all the way down. My father lives at the river level, and they're just hanging out by the house, and they have driven a herd of elk down for the first time in recorded history, because it's so cold and so snowy this year that they're putting tremendous pressure on what's traditionally been one of the largest elk herds in Montana, in the southern part of the state down there. And it's my understanding also that Boise, the elk are being driven into the city limits right now. We have a daughter who lives there. And I think LeGrand also, or one of the eastern Oregon cities, the elk actually are showing up on the hospital lawn because that's the only place that they are safe from the wolves. And right. so I just think it's really important to understand also that weather plays a really important part in this. When we have large numbers of wolves, it puts a lot of pressure on the elk herds and deer herds because they go down into these lower elevations, still being like a mile high or whatever in Montana. But, I mean, it's really disconcerting when you hear an 86-year-old man call and say, well, you know, the wolves are following me out to the mailbox.
Yes.
And so they are not afraid of people.
Following me.
They are, you know. So, I mean, this is something we can look forward to.
Yep.
Here in Oregon, and your testimony was excellent, and it goes along with what we are seeing right now in Idaho and Montana.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Whitsett. One thing I'd like to add, you're kind of an analogy to what you were talking about with the communities. We saw in our research area there on Big Creek in the winter, elk, their safety opportunity was the water. And I think the researchers in Yellowstone have demonstrated the same. When they don't have a town that they can evacuate to, basically they go to the river.
Yeah.
And we documented over 200 kills and wolves over a four-winter period. And the majority of those were occurring on the river ice. And it's because that's where the ungulates were going for safety. So thank you.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you. I'm curious about some past research. I'd like to know if it's possible to get hold of the predictions once those wolves were released in Idaho, and what the predictions were about what people anticipated was going to happen, and then what we actually saw happen, and in what ways that. Particular area that you were talking about, where is the bowl? That how does that translate to what we're seeing in Oregon? Mm-hmm. I know some of the ranchers over in eastern Oregon are dealing with certain areas that are like that. So mm-hmm. I'd like to have a sense of whether we're dealing with the same kind of thing, and just getting an idea of the predictive capabilities of the wildlife managers. And how that will relate to the management from now on, because I'd like to make sure that we are actually managing it, not just saying, oh, gee, let's see what happens.
Exactly, yeah. I can look into that. Of course, the situation in Idaho is a very complicated one. You initially had but the Nez Perce tribe were responsible for wolves as they were really getting some inertia and growing in number. And Idaho Fish and Game really didn't enter into the scene until about 4 or 5 years after they were established. But there was a lot of dialogue about that. I used to participate in the 90s into the early 2000s in an event in Chico, Montana, which was a wolf conference, and there was quite a bit of discussion about that. And the main projector of what was going to happen, the primary barometer was Yellowstone.
Right.
And myself and my wife and others were initiating research in Idaho as a comparative tool just to do what you're talking about. You can't just base everything on Yellowstone. In fact, it isn't very applicable to a lot of the rest of our western landscape. So,
well, just if you have that information,
yeah,
if someone
that to you.
Put that
yeah.
kind of research together, I'd like to see that if possible.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Anything further?
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. It's been exceedingly helpful. We'll call up the other half of your group. And Stan Steele, if you have any information that would assist in the science behind some of the impacts on ungulates, if you'd make sure that Mr. Roper receives that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you. Gentlemen, welcome. Please determine who goes first and proceed.
Thank you. Chair Witt, members of the committee, Rocky Dahlem on behalf of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. We want to thank the committee and ODF&W for taking this issue up, and it's been a long discussion, especially for this industry as well, and appreciate Senator Hansel and Representative Barreto and the work that they've done with producers. OCA, just as background, there are about 13,000 beef producers in the state, 2,000 of which are members of the Cattlemen's Association. And as this committee knows, agriculture is the number one industry in the state, and beef cattle is about 14% of that industry. So important for the committee, as you know, and we appreciate you tackling these issues that are really deep on science and sustainability and how we settle those issues. Interestingly enough, the cattlemen, as you know, represent really families and businesses in every corner of this state. Todd Nash from Mar Flat Cattle Company near Enterprise is here to talk, and I would characterize that part just today as he's right there in the whole ball of wax or the whole ball of yarn, as ODF&W showed, and can speak to this and has been working on this issue for a long time. I don't want to revisit the entire history that ODF&W talked about with the Wolf Plan, but I want to highlight a few things that are important to the industry. The Wolf Plan was really an agreement that was come into place by the agency, conservation groups, and livestock producers of all kinds. And the goal was to strike a balance between reestablishing wolves in Oregon, effective management, and the needs of those producers. And when I say the needs of those producers, I think it's important to highlight the sacrifices that have been made, and Todd can answer questions about that and how difficult this has been on producers over the past 10 years and the willingness that they've had to work and address this issue. And that leads us to where we are, at least in the hearing, and what we're asking for going forward is for the legislature to ratify and reinforce the decision of the commission to delist the wolf. And I want to highlight for the committee that and I think the Farm Bureau talked about this as well. But delisting does not mean that that will affect management of wolves and protection of wolves under the Wolf Plan. The Wolf Plan exists and continues to exist in the work that ODF&W will do. As you talked about a little bit earlier, the commission made that decision in November, and there has been notice of a petition review of ODF&W's decision and the commission's decision to move to phase two. The Cattlemen's Association is in strong agreement with the Farm Bureau on what you've talked about today, that the science is there, and you've seen a lot of good evidence, and even some evidence beyond what ODF&W has, but some suggestions that the science is very strong, that the wolves have returned and have met those conditions under phase two, or to move to phase two and move from move into the transition phase to the full phase three management. And what we're really asking is if the legislature can weigh in on that statutorily, it would give the certainty to producers and show them that the state is honoring the commitment that they made 10 years ago and then again 5 years ago when this was revisited. And that's very important. I think Todd's going to talk a little bit about that, but it's not just about honoring that commitment, but it's also upholding the credibility. And I think because of the strain that this has put on the industry and the work that they've done, if we don't have effective management moving forward, I think where Farm Bureau and the Cattlemen's Association have worked really hard to have members comply with the Wolf Plan and follow the guidelines, it gets more and more difficult to have individual producers continue to bear that burden if it doesn't match up with where the science is. On the sustainability side, which we know is a big deal to this committee, we did talk with Representative Barreto and others about some of that language that would require that if we dropped back down below, while that's unlikely, that that delisting would change. I think that the theory is because the Wolf Plan stays in place, that really all of the sustainability measures are captured in the Wolf Plan. So just ratifying that decision and adding to statute that the gray wolf's been delisted is important. So I don't want to cover the five factors that ODF&W highlighted, but that they've found that are clearly have been met, and it's time to move to phase two, and say that OCA is supportive of legislative language that would allow but to just reiterate that we're asking the legislature to take a look and weigh in and give the agency really the direction that it needs. And that will provide clarity to landowners. It will provide a benefit going forward. It will still protect the gray wolf, and it will avoid some of that costly and what we believe to be misplaced litigation and the cost to the state. So thank you for the time.
Thank you very, very much, Rocky. Appreciate that very much. And, Todd, I just want to state I recognize that when this bill didn't make it through last time, it was a grave disappointment to you and the people that you represent. And I just want to say thank you for your willingness to come back and engage in the process yet again. So thank you for being here, sir.
Yep, thank you. Chair Witt, representatives, my name is Todd Nash. I represent the Oregon Cattlemen's Association and the Wolf Committee chairman. In the handout that I just received there, it goes through some of the delisting processes that took place with U.S. Fish and Wildlife over time. And if you look at the highlighted spot there, there was a point there in 2011 when the House of Representatives introduced, along with a spending bill, to delist wolves in Idaho, Montana, Eastern Oregon, and Eastern Washington. That brought some sanity to that. It was no longer subject to judicial review. We'd been in and out of that time and again and again. Wyoming was excluded from that. And you can see below there that a final rule was published for delisting in Wyoming. There was more litigation. At the time, Wyoming has twice as many wolves as they were required to have by U.S. Fish and Wildlife. But it wasn't sufficient enough for different conservation groups, including Defenders of Wildlife. What we're asking you to do here today, and what we asked you to do last year, was to try to bring some sanity to this. It's not ODF&W that's able to manage this. It's the judicial system, and it's the ability for different conservation groups to sue at will to obstruct. In 2011, I had a 600-pound calf killed, and it wasn't my first kill. It was one of many that I and other neighboring ranchers had had, and we reached a tipping point to where ODF&W said, enough is enough. We are going to take some of the wolves out of the Minnehaha pack. ODF&W tried for a short while to take wolves out. Ironically, on October 5th, I had another calf killed. And on that day, there was litigation put forward by some of the same groups that have the litigation and judicial review put forward here today. And no wolf was able to be killed in the state of Oregon until we reached a settlement in 2013. Now, we went under a much more restrictive rule than we were before, and there's not been a wolf legally killed by ODF&W since. So, the wolf plan wasn't followed. And I want to tell you, there's quite a lot of heartburn over the fact that during 2011, 2012, and part of 2013, we watched depredation after depredation after depredation. And then once we were through that and through settlement, we watched more depredations, and we could never meet the settlement rules to have wolves that had been chronic depredators removed. Now, this was a promise that was made to us. If you have a pack of wolves that are chronic depredators, they would be removed. That is a promise unfulfilled. Now, when we got to delisting, we knew this was going to happen, and I warned you guys last year, and we talked about it, and we wanted to avert this. The last litigation the Cattlemen's Association entered into as interveners, we were over $60,000. We sold raffle tickets on trailers. We did a number of things. We didn't have $60,000 to spend. I don't know what it cost the state. I've never seen a good accounting of that. But I'm sure it was twice as much as what we spent. And here we are again. I want to bring some sanity to this and let the scientists and let the managers of our wildlife manage instead of a few conservation groups and a judge. Some of the impacts that having an endangered wolf that we've seen so far challenged. There was a logging job in Southern Oregon where OR7 had set up camp, and that was challenged by Oregon Wild. On my last grazing meeting with the Forest Service, there was a line item there for an endangered wolf, and how we might deal with that. Recreation roads, you can use your imagination how it might be challenged. Wolves are very adaptable. None of those things are going to slow the wolves down at this point. We have substantial habitat. ODF&W has meted that out. The other thing that comes with an endangered wolf is we've had places where there's been depredations on sheep by cougars, by coyotes, and some with cattle. But when you call up the government trapper, if they're in an aqua or a known wolf area, all of a sudden, if there's an endangered species there, there's a number of sets that are very effective for those targeted species that can't be used anymore because you have an endangered species in the area. Phase three of the Oregon Wolf Plan. And there hasn't been a lot of discussion about how that affects that exactly, but I want to give you an example, and it isn't very well spelled out in the handout I gave here, but in Northeast Washington, when they took out the wedge pack and the state decided that there had been a number of depredations, there had been enough confirmed depredations, they were going to take out the entire pack. And depending on who you talk to, it cost between $70,000 and $91,000 to remove those seven wolves. Now, if we move into phase three, which this time next year we could be in phase three, ODF&W would be allowed to give out permits, sell permits for that matter, to individuals to take out the wolf. And I've asked people from the department, are you willing to spend $90,000 to take out a pack of wolves? They said no. Russ Morgan told me no, coordinator of the Oregon Wolf. He said, if I spent $90,000, I'd get fired. They don't have the money put away for it. They don't have the wherewithal. The last time they went out to take out wolves, they sent two people out at a time with rifles strapped across their back. They didn't get it done. So, you know, do we want to spend the $90,000 or do we want to allocate tags? If we never get there to phase three, which phase three is a trigger point, that happens when we have seven breeding pairs for three consecutive years. That isn't a matter of voted on. That'll happen the same way that phase two did. We're already there. But if it's an endangered species, we're not capable of doing that. Lastly, I just wanted to point out the individuals who are suing here, and I didn't see Nick Cady here today from Cascadia Wild, but he sat here last year, and he told you guys that he would not, and Gail Wissett brought him out and said, would you, if the science prevails for the day, would you take suing off the table? He said, oh, no, we'd never do that. And he was good to his word. He is the lead attorney on the lawsuit here, and you have a copy of it there in front of you. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Committee members? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Todd, Representative McEwen asked me a question earlier about appealing a decision by Fish and Wildlife on the on a depredation, and I thought maybe you could explain that a little further and some of the frustrations that go with that.
Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, we've had situations, and the most dramatic one was last spring. We had OR-33 had a GPS collar on. I get information in the general area where he's at, and this particular morning, we get those downloads at 6:30 in the morning. This particular morning, it was a very small location. It was on a piece of private property, and I get those via text, or we can get them through email. And I saw where it was. I called my friend who doesn't have text in that area because it's in a non-cell phone area, and I said, did you check your email? He said, yes, I just saw it. We're going out to look. Found the calf. It was taking its last breath. He called me back and he said, should I even have it investigated? He described the scene. It was very much the pattern, eating pattern of a wolf. And I said, yeah, it sounds like a slam dunk. I actually went down there to the investigation, spent the entire day there. There was wolf tracks at the scene. There was skid tracks around where cows had tried to fend off the wolf. And then the eating pattern. There had also been, from the time that the wolf had left and the calf wasn't entirely killed, coyotes had come in and tried to take some out of him as well. And there was coyote bite marks on him as well, and I won't dispute that for a second. This was about a 275-pound calf, and all of my time of ranching, which has been fairly extensive, and I've calved hundreds of calves out year after year, I've never seen a coyote take down that big a calf. In the end, it wasn't confirmed. And to our frustration, it wasn't confirmed. We had every bit of evidence there. You know, you talk to our district attorney, and she said, I could win a murder case with this in any court anywhere. And yet, when we send it to ODF&W, at this point, wasn't confirmed. We have it appealed. The same people that made the decision to begin with are the same ones that are appealed to. We want that changed. We feel like there are certain times when we are not getting fair investigations, and it is frustrating beyond belief. And the investigator at the scene told us, look, we're in phase two now. If we get another depredation, we could go to lethal take. We have to be very careful. My response was, we have to be very accurate. And that's what we want. We want to be able to feel like we're getting a responsible investigation.
Representative McEwen.
Chair Witt, thank you. And Mr. Nash, it's nice to see you again.
Thank you.
The reason I raised that when Senator Hansel and Representative Barreto were at the dais is it is a conversation that we had when we came out to visit your area. And I just wanted to make sure that we had on record that this was an issue that I think it's important that in some way we address, if not in this short session, in the long session. Because it became very clear to me during the conversations that we were having with you and everyone else that we talked to while we were on this trip, that the chain of appeal didn't make sense to me. That you're making you have a contradictory outcome and you're making an appeal to the same folks that made the decision in the first place. So I just wanted to get on record today that it's something that I think we need to have a conversation about and pursue and make sure that these things are done accurately and done fairly. So that's why I raised it when Representative Barreto was at the dais. So thank you for following up and getting on record from your perspective how this impacts you all and why it's something that I think we ought to continue to pursue later.
Thank you.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Chair. Chair Witt and I had a nice tour as well. We sat in Cove, Oregon, for dinner and had the story.
Where?
Cove. This is a
little place in Cove,
Oregon. Yeah.
Apartment complexes in Portland are bigger than Cove.
That's right. And in my district are bigger than Cove. But we had a really good conversation, but we heard the same stories. And it was, and this was 2013.
Yeah. I told the story.
You were the one telling the story. I thought that might be the case, but we hadn't. But it was very disturbing. And one of the things, though, that I think was brought up was that we have examples of where this can be done well. And I was told that that was in Canada, that the Canadian Fish and Wildlife Program had managed to manage a number of things regarding the wolves. Is that still the case, or am I missing something there?
Chair Witt, Representative Fredericks, as far as just management of wolves and who's been successful, there's been times when Canada has been quite successful. Okay. When they took away the tool of using 1080, which was a poison. Mm. And what they did at that time was, if they had a depredation, they went and put 1080, and it was a very small amount. They said within the province of Alberta, they dispensed less than a teaspoon full throughout the entire province. It's potent, but they'd put a small capsule in this, in the underside of the cattle, and when the wolves came back to finish it up, those wolves were killed. When they took that tool away, they have had a difficult time since. I saw a recent study where in southern Alberta, that 45%, this is where game and livestock intermixed, 45% of the kills that wolves were taking were domestic livestock. The success that I've heard of is that when you have depredations and even before they become chronic, if you take out those particular wolves, it has been successful. In Salmon, Idaho, I have a friend close to where Jim Akinson was at doing his research, and he went through 12 years without having a single depredation. And I asked him, and he ran in timbered and big forest allotments. I said, "How did you manage to do that?" He said, "I didn't do anything." He said, "Some of my neighbors had depredations, but as soon as they did, they took those wolves out." And he said, "I have about 3 packs in around my cows, but they eat elk. That's what they depredate on." Since then, he has had some depredations, and he has taken some wolves out. But he never shot a wolf himself, never had an order for a wolf to be killed.
Thank you. Just follow
please.
Up. It was that targeted approach that you would, that I believe, that's what I was hearing about, not so much the poison, but the targeted approach. Mm. And I thought, in my reading of what I saw from ODF&W and the agreements, was that we were planning on doing something very similar if we saw that. Obviously, we haven't, and the result is has been pretty a struggle for you folks, clearly. I'd like to, at some point, talk with ODF&W about a couple of things, why we haven't had that follow-up on that, but it's something that we need to be doing, because that was part of the promise of the agreement that was made regarding the wolves, and I think we need to get back to that and follow it. Yeah. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Frederick. Important point. Anything else from the committee at this point? Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Appreciate that. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Scott Beckstead, Quinn Reed, and Sean Stevens. Welcome, each of you, to our committee, and I look forward to your testimony, and I want to make sure that every turn you keep us on the straight and narrow in terms of A, the science, and B, sustainability, because as far as I'm concerned, those are guiding principles here in this committee. So please decide among yourselves the order of your testimonies.
Right. Chair Witt, representatives, I'll start. My name is Sean Stevens. I'm the executive director of Oregon Wild. In 1947, the last wild wolf in Oregon was killed near Crater Lake National Park, and a bounty was paid out. That moment 70 years ago marked the culmination of an ugly chapter in our state's history, one that saw a state-funded campaign to eradicate wolves from the landscape come to a gruesomely successful conclusion. Wolves joined sea otters, wolverine, and condors on the list of wildlife driven to extinction in Oregon. Fast forward to today, and it's clear in some ways we've learned a lot, in others we have not. Wolves have been reestablished in the state for not even a decade. With less than 90 confirmed adults, their numbers are still low. ODFW reports that wolves only occupy 12% of suitable habitat, and the best available science suggests Oregon could host over 1,400 wolves. Even in the short time that wolves have been back on the Oregon landscape, 3 have been killed by government agents, and no fewer than 5 have been killed by poachers. The status of wolves in Oregon is still tenuous. We're here today to talk about ODFW's recent decision to remove wolves from State Endangered Species Act protections, and ostensibly to discuss whether this committee and this legislature should defy the public, affirm this decision, and set a dangerous precedent for wildlife in Oregon. Suffice it to say that Oregon Wild and our partners disagree with the process and the science that led to the delisting decision. We believe ODFW failed to comply with the law by not using the best available science. The agency received comprehensive and at times scathing critiques from world-renowned scientists that were not fully considered. The agency also ignored feedback it received from the vast majority of Oregonians who wanted to see protections remain in place for wolves. Of the more than 10,000 comments received during the review process, 96% favored maintaining listed status of wolves. As has been discussed, Oregon Wild and our partners have requested judicial review of the delisting decision to ensure it complied with state law. To be clear, we are not seeking an injunction. It will likely be over a year or more before a judge rules in this case. And in the meantime, whether we like it or not, wolves are delisted. Legislation is not needed to make it so. In their presentation to this committee, ODFW rightly points to the success of the current Wolf Management and Conservation Plan. It has been a model for the nation, reducing conflict between wolves and livestock through non-lethal means, all while the wolf population, as you saw, has slowly increased. Of course, the current plan is the product of a comprehensive settlement between the state conservationists and the cattlemen. The settlement was necessary because a judge suggested that the state's previous approach to wolf management was very likely in violation of the law. We should be thankful for that settlement and the new management plan. It has worked. In all of 2015, only 4 cattle were killed by wolves. Now, Mr. Nash and the Oregon Cattlemen's Association may dispute those numbers, as we've heard, but even if you triple them, quadruple them, the owners of those livestock were eligible for compensation for their loss. And for perspective, it's 4 cattle out of an estimated 1.3 million in the state. It's also worth noting that the livestock industry is booming. The Oregonian newspaper reported just last year, and I think it was mentioned, 14% of the industrial, or the rather the agricultural sector in the state is livestock. Revenue topped out over $1 billion across the state. It's making it the largest agricultural sector in Oregon. The industry's growth has not been stymied by the return of wolves, and we should not make wildlife management decisions based on the false notion that it has. The fact is, we treat wolves differently than almost any other endangered animal. In this day and age, we should know better. We must let the will of the public, the requirements of the law, and the best available science guide wildlife management decisions in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Who's next?
Thank you very much. Chair Witt and members of the committee, my name is Quinn Reed, and I'm here representing Defenders of Wildlife.
Welcome.
Thank you. On behalf of our 18,000 members and supporters across Oregon, we would like to express our opposition to this legislative proposal because we think it risks usurping the authority of the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission.
Quinn, thank you.
To effectively manage threatened and endangered species in Oregon. Our opposition is based on 3 primary grounds. First, and this gets to a concern that, or a question that Representative Frederick raised early in this hearing, that is that this is unnecessary. Wolves are delisted. They're delisted now. It is in effect, which makes legislative delisting simply unnecessary at this time. Second, it overlooks the stakeholder process to review and update Oregon's wolf management plan. Finally, it sets a dangerous precedent of amending the State Endangered Species Act and constraining the Commission's authority on a species-by-species basis. Getting back to my first point, the Commission voted in November 2015 to delist. As you, I'm sure, can guess, Defenders of Wildlife was not happy with that decision, but the fact is wolves are delisted, and management is proceeding according to that decision. The other thing I'd like to mention is that the Commission's authority ever to relist species again is grounded in Oregon Revised Statutes, Section 496.196, and the bar for relisting is extremely high. So there's simply no emergency here that warrants a legislative delisting. I have been listening to the many concerns raised by panelists here tonight, and so many of them are valid, and I'm absolutely hearing those. But something that I want to emphasize for all of you is that legislative delisting doesn't actually address any of those concerns. The Wolf Plan does. And that's why Defenders of Wildlife is focused on engaging in this broad stakeholder process to review and potentially update the Wolf Plan. We pride ourselves on our willingness to sit down at the table and to participate in these stakeholder processes, and I want the opportunity to do that again, to sit down with so many people in this room, the landowners, the cattlemen, the hunters, the conservationists, to talk about what wolf management looks like in Oregon moving forward. We're concerned about any initiatives that could circumvent the plan or this established review process that Mr. Blakely addressed earlier tonight. We're especially concerned about any initiatives that would deprive the public or stakeholders of the opportunity to participate. State law charges the Fish and Wildlife Commission with these important listing and delisting decisions. The procedure for delisting wolves specifically was agreed upon under the plan, and delisting was carried out accordingly. We believe that the commission is the appropriate body, though we don't always agree with their decisions. But we believe it is the appropriate body with the necessary scientific and legal expertise to make these decisions. Our members count on public and transparent processes to make sure their voices are heard. So again, we would urge this committee to allow the plan to proceed without legislative listing at this time. Finally, we're concerned that this sets a dangerous precedent for amending the State Endangered Species Act and constraining commission authority on a species-by-species basis. Unnecessary constraints on the commission's authority hampers effective wildlife management. We're concerned that it opens the door to a further chipping away of commission authority. I don't think this is in line with the original purpose of the State Endangered Species Act. For these reasons, we request that the committee oppose this measure and abstain from actions which will unnecessarily constrain the commission to allow the review and update of the wolf management plan to proceed. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Scott.
Good afternoon, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Scott Beckstead, Senior Oregon Director for the Humane Society of the United States. My co-panelists have said much of what my organization's position is, and so I'm going to try and keep my comments relatively brief. First of all, thank you, Chair Witt, for the opportunity to express our position on this important issue. Very often this committee sees me here in this chair being critical of ODFW programs and how it operates, especially with regard to predators. But I will tell you that the process of developing the Oregon Wolf Management Plan had an inherent fairness to it, a thoughtfulness to it, and a good faith effort, I think, by all the stakeholders to come up with a plan that that was as workable as it could be. And that collaboration is something that that we find very gratifying and that we hope will continue. But the legislation that's been proposed, we think, is unnecessary given the commission's decision to delist. And the concern is that by sort of piling on the existing delisting decision, that it starts us down a path that would has the potential of putting that plan and how we manage wolves starkly at odds with the humane values of most Oregonians. I look at what's going on in my home state of Idaho with regard to wolves, and there is a level of cruelty and depravity that exists among some of the wolf hunting crowd in Idaho that is quite frankly horrific. And all you have to do is go on Facebook at some of the wolf hunting Facebook pages, and the deliberate torture of these animals, the celebration of how they died, is something that I certainly don't want to see in Oregon. And I worry about us going down that path. You know, I looked at ODFW's proposal. The plan that they have mapped out for evaluating the effectiveness of the wolf management plan, I think, is fantastic. And in fact, as I was looking at all of their criteria and what they plan to do to evaluate the wolf plan, all I could think was, I hope they're going to do this for cougars when they reevaluate the cougar management plan. I hope they take that same approach. It would be great. The Humane Society of the United States would love to work collaboratively on this issue. We, as a national organization, we are looking not just at Oregon, but at the big picture in the United States, and we're very active in wolf issues in many other states. And we'd like to be part of that conversation, but we think that this legislation is the wrong step forward. But we certainly stand ready to work with the Commission, ODFW, and all of the stakeholders to achieve a result that is fair to everyone but also reflects Oregonians' very basic humane values. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you all very, very much. Committee members, questions or comments? Representative Barreto.
Yeah, Sean, thank you, Mr. Chair. Sean, you mentioned the public testimony, and it was overwhelming. But what I've heard, and Scott just mentioned it right now, the approval of the Wolf Plan and the work of ODFW, and it was always going to be based on the science, you know, not necessarily what the general public wanted. But now I hear this kind of, well, no, now we shouldn't go there because we have this popular sentiment. So would you kind of comment on that?
Well, I think public participation in these decision-making processes and the fact that we're here today testifying, that process is very important. And I would expect that ODFW would echo that they appreciate hearing from citizens and getting that public input. I think it's one measure of what goes into policy. And certainly on this policy, the public spoke overwhelmingly, and I think that's worth noting. We don't want to make decisions for wildlife based solely on what the public want, but I think it should matter. And when you think about the science, I think there are very real questions about whether or not the best available science was used. ODFW did consult with scientists. They hand-selected them. They set one deadline and then put out their recommendation for delisting before that deadline had passed, and therefore scientists who were putting in comments didn't actually get their voices heard. And I think overall it was a very troubling process where it felt like the outcome was preordained and not based on the scientific input that they were receiving.
Follow up?
Please.
Quinn, you mentioned that it was unnecessary to legislatively delist, but that they're delisted right now. And so, really, if we delist and give our approval to the Fish and Wildlife or to the commission that made that delisting decision, there's certainly nothing wrong with that then if the legislature sees that as fitting.
Chair Witt and Representative Barreto, thank you for that question. Legislative delisting is not contemplated by statute currently, and that's the origin of some of our concerns here, is that it sets a precedent for legislative action on a species-by-species basis.
Thank you.
Yes. Additional questions or comments? As policymakers, we have some choices and some decisions to make. And I frankly was encouraged by much of what you said. And I think it was in keeping with good Oregonians trying to find that middle ground. And the fact that each of you, I think, to some extent, maybe Scott less than the other two, but I think you credited the management plan with doing a good job. That's what I heard. I think a lot of folks that preceded you today would say, you know, the management plan, It accomplished what it set out to do. They may argue that some of the off ramps, some of the safety valves didn't work for them quite as they would wish that it would. But overall, the plan worked. I'm encouraged. I see people from two. It's probably hyperbole to say diametrically opposed positions, but it's probably not too far off either. I'm encouraged that Oregonians can at least agree on that much. That suggests that our science, the people that try to implement the plan, folks in the community, everybody tried to make this thing work. And I have heard both sides say, "Yeah, we'll give it a B." That's good. That's good. So we've got a place of agreement to start from. And now the decision that we have is policymakers central here is, do we move forward with a delisting or not? That's our bottom line, I think. It certainly is for me. And so if the plan was working, and the original agreement was at some point when we meet the criteria, we're going to delist. That's our difficulty here. I mean, by whatever measure I look at, we've arrived. Now, Scott, I am very cognizant of your admonishment. Don't go down the road of cruelty. But I want to take you up on your offer to work collaboratively. And I recognize your membership organizations, and I recognize that there are expectations from your membership. And I recognize that a delisting is probably not one of those. Okay, so short of that, as Oregonians, can we work together collaboratively to find that mechanism, to find that path that is not the cruel path? And certainly a take by any measure could be considered cruelty. I understand that. Out of the gate, I understand that. But could we ameliorate the possibility of cruelty happening to the point that this delisting is done in as humane and as Oregonians' approach to it as possible? And I recognize that is a very difficult question for you to ask, but I'm looking for that middle ground.
Chairwood, if I may, I think that it's a really good point because, you know, if you go back to 2005 and you look at the development of the first plan before we had wolves in Oregon, I mean, we had individuals coming here, but none putting down roots. There was that effort to identify what that common ground plan was going to be. And there were a lot of ambiguities in that plan when it was announced, and not everyone was happy with it when it was announced. Oregon Wild wasn't going out and cheering from the rooftops for it, but the Oregon Cattlemen's Association was filing a minority report and opposing it at the time. So we did have a plan that was, I mean, it was a compromise in every way that you can think of, in both good and bad terms. And when rubber met road on that plan, there was a lot of interpretation of it that was left to the agency. And that's why in 2013 we had the settlement, because it was trying to codify those ambiguities. And I think, as I said, we've had great success under that plan, and certainly not what everyone wanted. We heard testimony earlier about some of the legitimate hardships that are borne by the livestock industry. I think there are legitimate ones, and I think there are exaggerated ones, mm-hmm. but I think there are some legitimate ones. And I think the question to this committee and the legislature, thinking about delisting, is not foreclosing a review under the law of what that decision whether it was legitimate, whether it was in compliance with the law. Ultimately, that's what led to the settlement in 2013 that gave us the plan today, because we needed a judge to be able to come in and negotiate some of those disputes because there was a difference of opinion about what the law said. And I would argue that with a delisting in place, as it is, no changes in that happening anytime soon, with a wolf management plan review on the horizon, that the committee is fine letting it stand, because the action that you could take would only have potential negative consequences, I think, for management of wildlife going forward.
Scott.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I would add that when you look at the Federal Endangered Species Act, the Humane Society of the United States departed from many of our allies on this issue by taking the position that wolves should be listed as threatened rather than endangered, because that provided, for example, ranchers with greater authority to deal with individual problem wolves.
Interesting.
So, you know, I know that my organization certainly has some flexibility, but I can tell you also that the minute Oregonians see a trophy hunter beaming as he holds the dead body of an Oregon wolf,
I understand.
It's going to blow up into something really bad.
I understand.
And I just don't want that. And I would like to see balance. And I think that there is a good faith effort on everyone's part to try and get there. But, you know, it was frankly, it's alarming to even hear the word compound 1080 spoken in this room. I would hope that what we're doing here today isn't the first step down that path, and I trust that it's not.
I understand, and that brings a mental picture to many of us, myself included, that is unacceptable. Quinn, did you have something that you wanted to say?
Chair Witt, thank you, and thank you for making those points. I just wanted to mention briefly that I think the opportunity you're looking for is, that you're hoping for, is on the horizon, and that is ODFW and the Commission's planned review and update of the Wolf Plan. So allowing that process to proceed is critically important, and it's important for that process that the Commission have the authority granted to it by statute, and that gets back to my original concern about legislative initiatives like this potentially encroaching on the Commission's authority.
Thank you very much. Representative Frederick, followed by Vice Chair McLean, followed by Representative Witz.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've said this before. One of the issues that I keep running into is the issue of trust. And that is the concern that I have, and that everyone on the folks on many sides of this issue talk about slippery slopes. Everyone has their own particular slippery slope that they think is going to take place. And I think we need to recognize that and decide that we're going to try to interrupt that and say, okay, what are we really dealing with right here, right now? I am concerned about the lack of action that was promised for the cattlemen. I think that is uncalled for. And it helps create that problem regarding slippery slope. It is also a concern that you brought up just a minute ago. The moment that we have someone pictured with a wolf that they just shot on Facebook, an Oregon wolf, that's going to blow up everything. People will not like that at all. We need to figure out how we're going to deal with that. I think that we really do have a question of how we're going to handle this, and I'm more confident about the Commission's approach than I am other approaches. So I just want to say that. And I'm going to ask that you, a couple of things in both groups here. One is the livestock industry is huge. The cattlemen are small. Every animal that they have is important. It means how much they're going to be feeding their families for that month. So it is not just 04 for four cattle that are calves that went down. It's a significant impact
on that community, significant impact on that individual. And I would ask on the other side of that that we not spend as much time. I hope that we aren't that their whole goal is not to try to replicate the number of takings as we've seen in Idaho. I'd prefer to have us find a situation where we're not having to do that. So if that would be the best thing as far as I'm concerned. So I just ask that both of those things take place. Thank you,
Representative Frederick. Vice Chair McLean.
I've sat and listened, I think, for about 2 hours and 15 minutes. And the reason I didn't have any questions, everybody else was asking most of the ones I had. But really and truly, I do want to agree with Chair Witt that I do feel like people are coming along and working better together as we go through these issues. But we can't claim that if we don't follow through with what we've worked on in the past and make it so people trust to sit down at a table again. And so I really do agree that it's very important that the plan we have goes forward. If it gets amended, it gets amended. But it's got to go forward, and we've got to keep the promises that we made to everybody that was involved in the conversation. And there was just one other thing that I just can't let go, because, first of all, okay, Facebook, social media, yeah, it's brought a whole new world to us. And anybody can put up any video, and we can't do much about it. But when you say the word horrific, and you say you just, you know, wait till you see this guy with this wolf and his big grin. A lot of you have maybe never seen a field with 30 dead sheep and how horrific that might look. There are other elements and other visuals that could be put up as well. And I don't care if it's a cougar, I don't care if it's a coyote, I don't care if it's a wolf. We are dealing with predators. And the situation is we have urban areas and we have other species. And so we've got to find the system that protects the humans, because I've seen a child hurt as well by a predator that was close into an urban area. And so I think it's really important for us to keep the stories, you know, as calm and as, you know, neutral as possible when we're talking about what the effect of hunting or of take or of, you know, someone coming in and being a predator and taking something down, another species. Because all of it can be horrific as far as how it's done, depending on the actor. And if it's an actor and somebody who's a humane person, a humane hunter, or a humane process. So I just want to keep all of that as neutral as possible with all of us, but we've got to follow through. And I don't like to see money spent in courts. And so I think we have a lot of better places to spend our money. And so let's try, all of us, to keep talking and smiling and working with each other, because we need to do that for the community's welfare and safety.
Thank you, Vice Chair McLean. I have Representative Whitsitt up next, followed by Representative Esquivel.
I just want to echo what Representative McLean said. The most horrific videos I have ever seen in my entire life are of wolves eating live ungulates. Animals are still alive, and the wolves are pulling their entrails out. They're mm-hmm. destroying them. They're still alive. They're struggling. So we need to be very careful when we talk about, we can't control what a hunter somewhere puts on Facebook. But I will tell you, the worst things I have ever seen, ever, are pictures of wolves eating living animals. So, I mean, I think we just need to, you know, not use that as a ploy to the public. It goes both ways. So one of the things I wanted to know, what is it you want exactly for us to do? Do you want, since we have a lawsuit when the Wildlife Commission decided to delist, so do you want them to review everything again and then come up with another decision? And is that what you're after?
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, thank you for that question. I think what we're talking about here, and maybe first starting with sort of the imagery that we've been talking about, I think it's good to divorce the decisions that we're making from the images we can conjure in our minds on both sides. I will say that I think it, you know, native species doing their natural thing in the wild, the sort of stuff we see on the Nature Channel, is a little bit different than our conscious acts to take out guns and kill animals. I personally don't hunt, but I don't have a problem with people that do. But I think we can draw a line between those things if we want to. I think to the specific question that you raised, we're talking about the promises made in the plan and agreements made, and I want to underline something that ODFW said earlier, and it's something that is written in the plan no less than six times, which is that delisting was to be considered at this point. When we reached this marker moving from phase one to phase two, ODFW was to consider it. And 2005, when this plan was drafted, is a long time ago in terms of scientific advancement. I like to think about the fact that we used to pull all the trees out of streams because we thought it was good for the salmon. We know better now. And I think in 10 years, and this was echoed in the national case with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Northern Rockies wolves, we had a lot more information 20 years on from 1995. And that's exactly what we were hoping ODFW was going to be looking at. The new science, the new understanding of management of wolves and how the population was going to be sustained. And so I think what we're looking for is to see if they complied with the law. If not, then there would be a new process to look at the science again and understand better what the benchmarks might be for recovery.
So a follow-up question. If the commission looks at all of your information and listens to all of your people, right, and they still decide to delist, are you going to sue?
I mean, I think this is the same question that my colleague answered the last time, and basically, in the future, I don't know what the process is going to be. If we feel that they've responded to our concerns and looked at all the science, there would not be justification to bring a lawsuit because the decision would have been made by the correct legal requirements.
Follow up.
So the only answer is your answer. The only answer you're telling this group and this legislature that unless the answer is what you want, then you're going to sue.
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, my answer is that if we feel the law is being broken, then we will try to enforce the law.
Representative Esquivel is next. And committee members, given the time, if we could make that the last question, I would be most appreciative. Representative Esquivel.
Save the best for last.
There you go. Absolutely, sir.
First of all, I think what has been said here is very good on the part of the legislatures. I agree that you have to watch your terminology here, folks. And I mean carefully watch your terminology. I think people brought up, Representative Whitsitt brought up a real good example of, have you ever seen an animal bitten, eaten? Well, it's alive. And I watch a lot of National Geographic and I see it. The other thing is, when this population grows, what's wrong with having tags? And what's the problem in Idaho? Is there a big outcry in Idaho because somebody puts a wolf on Facebook? I don't think so. They seem to get along just fine out there. So I just want you to be aware of what you're saying and be careful.
And with that, unless you have a response.
I would just, Chair Witt,
yes,
for the entire panel, I was raised on a cattle ranch in Idaho, and I understand how heart-wrenching it is to lose an animal for any reason. And so I certainly understand the hardship that the cattlemen are facing.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony very much. I recognize that it's probably not been easy, all the questions that we've asked you. But I want you to know that your appearance is genuinely appreciated. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Committee members, before I gavel this portion of our meeting closed, I just want to take note that we had a room full of people here today with very divergent viewpoints, and at every turn, it was respectful, and it was done in a manner in which I would consider supportive of the democratic small d process. And I want to thank every witness that appeared here today for their conduct. Thank you all very much. With that, I am going to close the informational meeting on wolf management in Oregon. And committee members, bear with me here. We've got a couple of procedural things that I'm going to, hopefully we can rapid fire. So you told me earlier that there were no one had a personal bill that they wanted to bring up today. So I'm going to open an informational meeting on member bills. Is there any member who is bringing forward a member bill today? Seeing none, hearing none, I'm going to close the informational meeting on member bills.
That was quick.
And with that, I am going to open a work session on the introduction of committee legislative concepts. To this point, we have an aviation bill that is my intention. It's inappropriate for that to be before us. And I think the Transportation Committee would be a great place for that to reside. And so that would be my intent, but we've got to accept the bill before we can move it. So, and number two, we have the Wolf delisting bill to accept. And committee members, do you have any discussions on either at this point?
Representative Woods.
I just want to say I made my LA take the aviation bill out of my packet because I said, that's not in our committee.
Very
she
good.
Said, look, it isn't. So
very good. Any other discussion? Seeing none, hearing none, I'm going to recognize Vice Chair Krieger, please.
Chair, would I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills? Number one is LC 166, dated December 21st, 2015. And the second bill is LC 277, dated December 4th, 2015.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 166, dated December 21, 2015. LC 277, dated December 4th, 2015. Is there any discussion on his motion? Seeing none, hearing none, is there any objection to his motion? Seeing none, hearing none, the measures as introduced as committee bills passes. Thank you, committee members, very much. And I will now close the work session on the introduction of our legislative concepts. And with that, my deepest apologies to the folks from Penwer that we made, Senator, we made you wait so long that all of your colleagues left. They abandoned you. But with that, open the informational meeting on Penwood.
Mr. Chair, does that mean we know how to clear a room?
Yeah, I think we just did it. Senator, my apologies. Welcome to our committee. Thank you for coming today. Sorry we made you wait so long. But
no, it was
you can appreciate the nature of what we just heard, I think.
Being from Idaho, we deal with wolves all the time.
I'll be
so.
Right back. Thank you.
And it's an ongoing issue. But I'm here to talk about another species this morning. I think it's actually probably much more dangerous to our economy than wolves. I'm going to keep this very brief, respecting your time. I sit on an afternoon committee as well, and this is the time of day where it gets painful. I am Kurt McKenzie. I'm a senator from the state of Idaho, and I'm president of Penwer. And if you're not familiar with Penwer, it's the Pacific Northwest Economic Region. We're made up of the five Northwest states and the five Western Canadian provinces and territories, the three provinces and two territories. You may have heard about quagga zebra mussels. It's a small invasive species. We first saw it in the U.S. about 1990. Came from the Ukraine in ballast water, Lake Erie and the Great Lakes. It loves our waterways, and it spread quickly throughout the United States, U.S. and Canada, basically, until it got to that region that circled there. That's basically the area in North America that they do not exist in, which is the Pacific Northwest Economic Region. They do have a devastating effect on fishing ways, on bodies of water. There's, you can see
a boat that's been in those waters. They cover every hard surface, and they have a huge impact on irrigation, on energy, especially hydroelectric states like Idaho. We get half of our electricity from hydro plants. And just recreation, they clear out the phytoplankton from everything else. They suck it all up. Water's very clear, but everything's dead. There's nothing to live on. They just take over our native species. The state of Washington had given Penware the job of making an estimate of what the cost would be to our region once we get them. On the next slide, our study showed. I don't know how to advance the slides, but Christy, thank you. Oh.
Oops. We'll get it back for you, don't worry.
Let's do page down.
Let's see, if you scroll with the mouse, that'll work, and that'll work also. Okay. Yep, there you go.
So basically, we're looking at, and for our region across the four states, it's about $500 million every year, recurring costs. There's no way that anyone's found to actually kill these things. In Manitoba, they tried to use potash to kill it, and it would kill a certain area, but it wouldn't wipe it out of a lake. And you can't get rid of this species and not kill off everything else. So you're stuck with them, and they're just really expensive. And so what we've done at Penware, we've in our member states, including Oregon, we've tried to set up a perimeter to inspect boats, watercraft, trailers coming from areas that are infested, like California, and try to prevent them from getting into our waterways. And so far, we've been successful, and we've intercepted a number of boats coming that have been infested. Over the last year, we've been back in Congress trying to get some funding for the inspection stations to help us be a little bit more robust, keep them open longer hours than we do now. Mike Simpson from Idaho sits on the financing subcommittee that oversees this, and he's very familiar with it, as well as all our delegation from our region have been really great. And so we were able to authorize up to $20 million to fight the problem. And then in WRDA, the Water Resources Development Act, we actually appropriated $4 million for our region in order to match what the states are doing. And so far, we don't quite, as a four-state region, spend $4 million, but we're pretty close to that. And this is going to hopefully match not only what we spend, but also in-kind contributions. So if there's other jurisdictions, if the tribes, if people donate their time, we can match that. Oregon's got a great program. Idaho does, too. You get yours through permit sales, $675,000 or so. You've raised that over the last six or so years to fund your stations. Hopefully what we can do through this program is set up a border so that Washington, we don't necessarily need as many stations in the state of Washington if we've got them in Oregon, Montana, and Idaho covering our points of access. And so it's a regional problem. It's something that we've all worked on together. You had passed a resolution last year requesting this funding. We're going to probably ask Oregon and our other members to pass a similar resolution, because if we can get in the federal budget in 2017, it's very likely it'll be a recurring amount. There's not earmarks anymore, but It's a program that can definitely be sustained over time, and Penware's kind of been leading that with the support of you and the other jurisdictions. So, Chairman, that's really all I wanted to report on to you. It's a huge issue when we look at the economic cost and all the jurisdictions that have it. We don't. We've got the best program in the country in inspecting and stopping them. But we're just going to need continual support to make it keep going.
Thank you so very, very much. Senator, just tell us a little bit about yourself. What committees you work with or chair in your home state, and what part of the state you come from?
Thanks, Chairman. I'm in Nampa, which is near Boise, the capital. I've been in the legislature since 2002. We have two-year terms, like your House members do. So we run every 2 years, Senate and House. And I chair State Affairs, which in Idaho is kind of a catch-all for all the social issues. So if we had a wolf debate, we would probably get that. We have gambling, gaming issues, if it relates to alcohol, if it's abortion, if it's any of those controversial issues, we get them in State Affairs. So it's always entertaining.
Aren't you lucky?
this committee, your committee meeting reminded me of one of ours.
There you go.
You handled it very diplomatically. I appreciate it.
It builds character, I assure you.
It does.
Representative Krieger.
Beware that there is a member of this committee that's bought property in Idaho and plans on moving there.
We'll keep an eye out for Oregonians coming our way. It's Californians that worry us.
Yes.
We have the same problem.
I know I had the good fortune to chat with you earlier today and about this in particular, and we have an opportunity to get some federal funds here to assist the management and prevention of invasive mussels. And I was very interested in the figures that that you presented. We can put relatively small amounts of money up front to avoid the problem, or you know, we run the risk if with the introduction of the pest it was like $500 million.
Yeah, it's $500 million, and as you say, it's a relatively small amount, and we may even be able to shake that money loose through the Army Corps of Engineers this year, this spring. In fact, we sat down with you earlier to figure out whether we needed to go through ways and means here to make that money happen. But
yes.
We'll track that down.
Great, and my staff actually has been working on that here today. So
yeah, I appreciate that.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We in Southern Oregon have had, I think we've completely killed all the life in Hyatt Lake, I want to say two or three times in my lifetime. And we've also just spent $6.4 million in Diamond Lake to eradicate the chewy chub.
How many times did we do that?
That's right.
They just caught one.
Oh, again?
Yeah, and they found out that fish was 6 years old. So we're back at it again.
Yeah, it's, when you have invasive species, prevention is where you have to spend your money, because once you have them, you can't get rid of them.
Yeah,
it's very, very difficult.
Fish was a Democrat.
That's persistent. Is that what you're just saying?
Now, we were pretty civil.
Survivors and persistent.
But I don't know if ODF&W missed the one at Diamond Lake, didn't get them all, or what, or somebody's reintroduced them, because what people do, they'll use those as live bait.
Right.
And throw them in the water, and then when they're getting ready to go home, they just throw the whole group in the water.
Yep.
Which in turn causes the problem.
Then 5 or 6 years later, you get to poison the whole thing all over
again. Exactly. You get to do it again for another $8 million.
So, Senator, thank you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the time in front of your committee. I know you are very busy now.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Whitson.
So, have you seen the elk that are coming down into Boise?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, yes. In fact, we didn't. Sometimes there's huge herds that come down, and I flew over areas just east of Boise, between Boise and Mountain Home, and seen maybe 100 out there. But yeah, you can, and there's tracks everywhere, so they're definitely coming down out of the hills.
Mm-hmm. Just want to make sure that news was correct. That I was kidding.
Yep. Representative Frederick,
thank you.
Have somebody that lives there.
Daughter.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have, and it's usually unknown, but in the basement of a laboratory building at OSU is the is a library of the aquatic species that have been found in the state of Oregon.
Well, but that's scary.
And they have a museum, but it's a small museum. Well, it's got quite a few. Some of the oddities. I would love to find a time when they were found and eradicated.
Wow.
in the state of Oregon, because that's something that we really need to be aware of. This is a real danger.
Yeah.
to the water here.
Mr. Chair, on the other hand, we planted, I guess in 1915, we planted some kind of a crawdad in Crater Lake.
Yeah.
And now they've become a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Well.
So, but we did that.
Oh yeah.
There were also fish there that were planted
right.
as well.
Yeah. We collectively have introduced a lot of pests, both plant and animals.
That's
so.
True.
And continue to do so, and that's why it's so important for us to be on top of that. If you take a look at the very first slide with the mussels all over that prop,
right.
Look at that. I mean, and that's anything and everything that's in the water, and I mean the cost to industry that may want to be using the water, the cost to our native species, and on and on and on. You know, ounce of prevention, folks, ounce of prevention. And thanks to PennWorry, we may have some matching money to be able to continue the good work that we've already started.
Yeah, well, thanks to all of us for working on that.
Senator, is that a quagga mussel or is it a zebra?
I can't tell the difference.
They're very similar. Is it quagga mussel?
Yeah, I can't tell where that picture was taken. Yeah.
But I also want to note that it hasn't been just our committee. The group of folks for PennWare have been in the building all day long trying to educate people on this program. And thank you so very, very much for all of your time and efforts.
Thank you, Chairman.
And with that, I'm going to close the informational meeting on PennWare. Anything for the good of the order, folks?
Nope.
Seeing none, hearing none. We'll see you all in a couple of weeks?
Yep.
Yeah. We stand adjourned. Thank you all very much. Yeah. We stand adjourned. Thank you all very much. Weeks.
Yep.